May it please the court, John Idell. I'm from Baton Rouge, represent Thomas Nelson in this proceeding. And from the outset, I need to advise the court, and I'm going to apologize before I say this because I should have made this decision sooner, but I'm going to give up on my McDonald argument and abandon that claim. I believe I should have done it sooner, and I apologize for causing everybody, and I've already apologized to Ms. Jones for causing y'all extra work, but I believe the claim had been procedurally defaulted. I will address the ineffective assistance of counsel argument then only, Judge. This case, both sides.
Let me just say this, counsel, it may well be the right thing for you to have done. I need to think through that, but regardless, a late assertion of what you now see as the proper conduct is appreciated. It's fine that you have made that assertion here today in abandoning the McDonald, and the timing of it is not a worry to the court.
Thank you, Judge. I didn't file my reply brief to her McDonald arguments, and I was stymied then, and I'm still stymied. So it's time to give up on that, but thank you, Judge. The ineffective assistance of counsel argument, and Ms. Jones is very forthright in both her briefs that she wrote in the lower court after the evidentiary hearing and in her brief to this court that Mr. Pate was ineffective. And I'm not going to recite all the different ways, but in a nutshell, that he didn't advise Nelson of the pros and cons of accepting this plea agreement, which was very advantageous.
To what extent should we consider the entirety of the advice that the defendant receives? Because he did have the other two attorneys, which, as I understand your argument, Mr. Nelson would have been well served to take their advice as opposed to this counsel. Shouldn't we consider the advice of counsel to be all of his counsel leading up to the time of his conviction?
If Your Honor, please, I think that Pate had a duty from the get-go. When he wrote the letter of July 2nd, he shouldn't have wrote it not knowing what he was doing, but that doesn't answer the issue of causation. Causation and prejudice may not be proven as of July 2nd. Game changer on July 7th, Pate wrote to Mr. Nelson's father an email that his son would be indicted the next day, and he would meet him in Louisiana, and they actually did meet the following day on July 7th. He forewarned him that an indictment would issue. An indictment did issue on July 7th, and it didn't say loss but it said that Nelson was involved in transactions that were over $6 million. And the trial judge, in sentencing him, I think it was $6.3 million, and that it was over $2.5 million, so it put him in the 235 to 293. So the stakes were higher then. The threat of if you don't take the plea bargain is different because something worse is going to happen than the thing happening. The second thing that happens, and I think this is the whole crux of my argument, is Pate says he got hired on July 1st, even though he had been talking to him before that in June. Pate didn't have any notes to produce memoranda, and I'm not faulting him for that, but they're just either not available or he wasn't doing it at the time. But when he meets with Nelson and his father, and the father is the one that's funding both sets of lawyers, is what Mr. Nelson, Tom Nelson Sr. testified to, he tells him two things. He tells him, one, that Ollie Pearson, Fred Kafassi negotiated plea bargain deal was bad, horrible, word to that effect, wouldn't say bad deal. And he then tells them the magic words that every person on the verge of going to prison, and maybe even more so the parents, because parents sometimes are more protective of the children than the children are themselves. They want to hear. He says, I can win the case based on entrapment. And what he should have said was, I don't know. I haven't investigated the case. Kafassi and Pearson, they spent about a month, and they did an intensive investigation. I shouldn't say intensive, but the government even gave them FBI 302 summaries under the understanding that they had to return them, which they did. And so they had the confession that Nelson had given. They have the timeline of the different events, the different transactions. And there was a gap in the $5,000 payments. That came in May, I believe, of 2010, where the investigation started in 2008. So even though he may not have been, the government may not have been, I don't know, baiting him or whatever with this fictitious company sting at that time, he's the one that then solicited later on, 2 years later, and then in 2010. And so to say I can win on entrapment was just wrong. If he would have said, I don't know, and I didn't put Mr. Nelson on the stand, and Ollie Pearson was not called. And there were tactical reasons for that. Ollie Pearson was called by the government in the case in chief to state that the plea agreement, and that's where the stipulation of facts, the poison pill, as Ms. Jones, so that's a great term for it, where the stipulation of facts that's built into the plea agreement has in essence a confession. And that was argued in closing argument by Ms. Jones and the initial close by the government and on rebuttal by Mr. Amundson. And entrapment, I think, is a difficult defense to begin with, but to know nothing about the case, to then advise both Nelsons, this is a bad deal, I can win the case. And what I'm trying to say, Your Honor, with respect to your question about causation, if Pate wouldn't have detoured them off of the Pearson-Kafassi deal, I think that there's a reasonable probability that he would have pleaded guilty as he reasoned. Now, there's a couple of...
But isn't that, I mean, at some point, I guess I'm trying to understand the argument that the defendant controls the case. The defendant makes the decision. Happens every day in both state and federal courts where a defendant says, well, I accept this deal, I will plead to X, Y, and Z terms. Or, no, I choose to go to trial, I'd like to have a jury hear my case and make a decision, render a verdict based on the evidence. And in this case, Mr. Pate, you say he was uninformed about the case and he made a recommendation about the entrapment defense probably being successful. He had a lot of confidence in the case. And we know that happens every day too, where defense lawyers take their best shot on behalf of their clients, clients get convicted. That doesn't rise to the level of ineffective assistance. But in this case, Mr. Nelson had not only two other lawyers, Ms. Pearson, who's a very accomplished attorney, and Mr. Kafassi, also fairly experienced attorney, who are telling him this, discussing the entrapment defense and telling him this is a good deal and you should accept it. And then on top of that, his father's an attorney, and I don't know what area of the law his father practices. Maybe it's an unfair implication, but at least his father was there as an advisor who had some legal education enough to be a licensed attorney. Why does this level of Mr. Pate's advice in this case rise to the level of overall ineffective assistance of counsel? Just because he was mistaken, why should the court grant relief to Mr. Nelson on the basis of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Well, he gave him wrong advice that was uninformed. I've already stated that, but let me move on to the July 12th letter that Mr. Amundson, once the indictment occurs, I think it would have been safe, I would have assumed at least, that negotiations were over. Plea bargain's out. You're going to get tried by the government. But surprising, at least to me, Mr. Amundson writes a letter to the trial judge to whom the bill of information was allocated, Judge Jackson, who is actually the one that has had this case below, the evidentiary hearing. And it states that we'd like for the court to schedule an arraignment, and that was scheduled eventually on August 3rd. And to give Mr. Nelson an opportunity in open court where everybody can see that he's knowingly, intelligently making a decision. And Ms. Jones and I stipulated in the evidentiary hearing that had he waived indictment, that's how the bill of information eventually got dismissed on Pate's local counsel's motion in late July, because he wouldn't agree to waive indictment. But she stipulated, the government stipulated, that if he would have pled guilty on August 3rd, that he could have still availed himself of the plea agreement. And so this is a different dynamic. He's under an indictment now with a potentially $6 million loss. And I originally didn't know that didn't stick with the Court of Appeals. Eventually they stipulated it was $400,000 to $1 million. Was the value on remand. But you got it. Pate has to take another look at it and tell the client your exposure has ratcheted up from what it was. And I think I used 3.5 times. I did the math again using the minimum sentences, and Ms. Jones's calculation actually at 36 to 47 months, I believe is correct. And so I'm coming up with 6.5 times a greater sentence with that increased value. And so I don't think we can look at it in just a snapshot at, say, July 2nd. I think and basically what I'm saying is that he gave uninformed advice on July 2nd. So say he gets a pass for that, even though both Ms. Jones and I have both written to the contrary. But events change on July 7th, and then on July 12th, this is actually he didn't tell him about. Pate testified that when he got that later, I didn't give it much thought. He was under the impression, and I'm not sure if this is kind of what Your Honor might be thinking, that once Nelson decided to try it, that he didn't have to, I think his words were, push back on the defendant to change his mind. Well, Pate testified that he got hired on July 1st, and I can't tell you if there was any communications, but if he got hired on July 1st, I think it's a reasonable inference that the same type conversation would have taken place for him to get hired to begin with, and he wouldn't have gotten funded.
Do we know what day in particular and by what vehicle Ms. Pearson and Mr. Crisafe were terminated? Did they get a letter from Mr. Nelson saying, I'm switching counsel, or were they still involved in the background?
I think it all kind of went on July 1st and July 2nd.
But when you say it all went on, I understand what happened. What I'm asking is, when did their turn? Your argument is that Mr. Pate got involved, and he's the one who rendered the ineffective assistance, and he's the one Mr. Nelson was depending on at that time. What happened to his prior counsel? Were they terminated officially, or were they just told to stay in the background, I'm here to try the case? How did that go down?
I believe they were terminated. The record's not clear on that. The memoranda that were introduced, that were generated by now Judge Crafassi, it doesn't have a determination. It ends in like late June, I think maybe with the signing of the plea agreement with Ms. Pearson. It doesn't state that. And so all we have in the record is Pate getting hired on July 1st. And I think a reasonable would be that there would have been at least by that. They were off the case by that time.
Okay.
But right, again, counsel, they never would. Oops, excuse me, Your Honor.
We'll hear from you again. We've heard your name a few times already, but you get to respond now.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Tricia Jones, and I represent the United States. Let me begin by addressing an issue that I neglected to address in my brief, which is the issue of remedy. The defendant argues in his brief that the proper remedy, should this court find ineffective assistance of counsel, is to vacate the convictions and sentence and to remand the matter for resentencing as if the plea agreement had been entered into. But that's not the correct remedy. According to the Supreme Court in Lafler versus Cooper, the correct remedy is for this court to order the United States to reoffer the plea agreement and to remand the matter. And should the defendant actually enter the plea agreement and enter his plea, it will be at the discretion of the district court whether to sentence the defendant according to the plea agreement alone or and vacate all of the trial convictions and sentences, or to vacate some or none of the trial convictions and resentence the defendant accordingly. So most of the discretion here is still with the district court, and some of these or all of the trial convictions may remain in effect, even if the court does find ineffective assistance of counsel in the rejection of the plea agreement.
Let me make sure I understand the issue that Mr. Nelson is raising. It does seem to me if what this case now boils down to is the ruling on ineffective assistance of counsel. The only ruling we have is that there was no causation, no prejudice from the potentially ineffective advice, poor advice from the final counsel. Is that correct? Does this come down to whether that is a legitimate fact finding?
That's what it comes down to.
Okay, if it is a legitimate fact finding, and we have a standard you can probably recite as to how we review fact findings, it does seem to me that there is it's a very difficult analysis to make of what role did this advice have in the decision that was made by Mr. Nelson that proved to be so harmful to his interests. What is the biggest shortfall, would you say, in the evidence of why it is proper to say that there's not enough there for prejudice? What's missing?
Your Honor, the district court made three particular fact findings that I think are well supported by the record, and those essentially are the shortcomings in the defendant's case, because he can't show that they're clear error. First off, is the district court found, as a matter of fact, that when the defendant hired Mr. Pate, he simply did not wish to plead guilty at all. So it didn't matter what kind of advice he would have received from Mr. Pate about pleading guilty. We know that he already received good advice. He would not have pled guilty. And I cited the White case, an unpublished case from this circuit, in my brief that was similar. There, the defendant got inadequate advice from his defendant and passed up a plea agreement. But because the record supported that the defendant was adamant about going to trial, the court held that there was no prejudice.
Well, respond to this. It strikes me one way to view this evidence is that there was a defendant who was just desperate for somebody to tell him that he can get out of this, that his whole life as he thought it was going to play out isn't going to play out that way. And he's agreed by this legitimate advice from, I don't want to overstate it, but by the advice of his first two counsel. I'm sorry, your life is the way you want it to play out. It's not going to happen. And then here comes a new lawyer and say, I got your back. And all this is quite likely going to work out. I mean, that is very hard to overcome, maybe. And that's one way to view the evidence. You got any response to that sense of what this case is really about?
Your Honor, I agree with you to some extent. I think he was desperate to go to trial and to have this all go away and not actually get in court and say I'm guilty. But I think even if Mr. Pate had told him, you know what, this is a good deal, he would have found another lawyer. He was desperate, and he was going to find somebody to take the case to trial. And to me, that's why.
He would have found somebody ineffective enough to tell him he had a chance to win, is one way to look at what you're saying.
Perhaps, Your Honor. I think it was bad judgment on his part. And he was definitely reluctant to enter a plea. And even from the beginning, even he agreed to it, but he didn't authorize its submission to the government. He started telling people, he went to see the executive director of the National Conference of Black Mayors to try to convince her to help him to somehow avoid prosecution in a political manner, and that information came out at trial. He was searching for a way to go to trial. Now, and even if his counsel had given good advice and said, even if he had stayed with Mr. Pate might have said, look, I don't know enough about it, I need more time, let's look into it, it's your choice, these are the consequences, all of the stuff that Ms. Pearson and Mr. Kerfassi had already told him, and then said, but it's your decision, and if you want to go to trial, I will take it to trial. I'm a fantastic trial attorney, and I will get you off. And he is an excellent trial attorney. I don't think he would have entered that plea. The evidence, you know, from every point, from his own father, who had to call him to tell him to authorize it, to Mr. Pate himself, who said when he came ready to go to trial, to the evidence at trial about his machinations to avoid prosecution at the same time period when he was getting out of the plea agreement. The second fact finding by the district court that I think is important in showing there's no prejudice, and Judge Engelhardt has brought this up in particular, is that the defendant was already properly advised and he understood the plea agreement. And the district court found both of those things, and both are supported by the evidence. Mr. Kerfassi and Ms. Pearson did everything that competent counsel would do in the 6 days between when Mr. Amundson offered the plea agreement and when Mr. Nelson verbally agreed to enter the plea agreement. They had meetings, they had phone calls, they looked into the evidence, into the defenses. They talked about the increased value. I mean, the idea that the $6 million value was something brand new on July 7th when the indictment came down is not true. The prosecution said, look, this was about business worth millions of dollars, and you are getting a great deal by a $22,000 valuation on this bribery activity, because it could be millions. And that was something that Mr. Kerfassi and Ms. Pearson had already discussed with the defendant. The defendant already knew about the poison pill provision. He already knew that the government had gone so far as to agree to file a 5K motion, not just to consider a 5K motion, but to agree to file a 5K motion. They inquired about entrapment. They talked to the defendant about that. They let defendant listen to one of the tapes. They did what they needed to do. They researched the sentencing guidelines, and although Mr. Kerfassi made a mistake about the initial base level guideline, it actually should have induced Mr. Nelson to be more interested in pleading than less interested in pleading, because they thought it would be only an 18-month sentence. And finally, I'm not sure if the defendant is relying anymore on his declaration about, if I had been advised that the sentence was 24 to 30 months, I would have entered a plea, because that's the only direct evidence we have here about what defendant would have done. He did not take the stand. We don't have anybody who heard him talking about what he would have done had he gotten the good advice. So the only direct evidence is that declaration, and the declaration itself is not credible, because defendant is not credible, also because it's not credible to say that you would plead to 24 to 30 months, but you wouldn't plead to 18 months. That doesn't make any sense. It's not credible because of all the other things he said in the declaration that were not true. And of course, it's my guess that that's why Mr. Nelson didn't take the stand at the hearing, because his declaration was so filled with untruths. There were numerous instances of defending telling untruths at during the investigation, and that evidence came out at trial. So the declaration simply cannot be believed. And at bottom, Your Honor, it is the defendant's burden to prove the reasonable probability that he would have entered the plea had he gotten different advice from Mr. Pate. And he just has not satisfied the burden. Most of the evidence tends to show that he just wanted to go to trial. That's what the district court found. And I don't see how the court can find that that's a clearly erroneous finding based on all of the evidence. And unless Your Honors have additional questions, that would complete my argument. Thank you.
I was going to address the first contention that Ms. Jones just stated about in LaFleur, that it was up to the court and therefore the district, federal district court in this case. The LaFleur was a Maine state court prosecution and decided the same day, Missouri versus Fry. I don't know what state they were from, but it was both state court cases, and I believe in Missouri versus Fry, when they remanded it for resentencing, it was like in accordance with state law. So I think the remand to the federal district court, of course, would be federal law would govern the proceeding. So I would urge that if the court were to agree with me that all the counts that he was convicted of be vacated, he'd be offered the opportunity to plead it, and then I believe Ms. Jones is correct. It would be up to the trial judge, I suppose, to accept it, but I don't see how he couldn't in this scenario. The argument about the trier of fact making findings, despite 5 pages of expansive description that Ms. Jones made in her post-hearing memorandum with the district judge, the district judge nonetheless found that there was no ineffective counsel present, and that was not proven, which is contrary to all the facts of the case and the law. I agree with Ms. Jones that it's iffy as of July 2nd, and in response to the Your Honor's question about whether you can basically use as a substitute the advice of Profassi and Pearson, and that's the same thing that I had argued earlier about the pushing back. And I quote from the government's brief, the post-trial memorandum brief, and it states in part that Pate is not confident he provided the defendant with any advice regarding the plea agreement before he communicated to the government the defendant's refusal to plead guilty. At one point, he acknowledged he didn't think he advised the defendants of the consequences of the breach prior to notifying the government that he was withdrawing. And then it goes on to say that apparently he thought it was not in the government wrote, but that's a poor excuse for facilitating defendant's breach of the plea agreement, ensuring that he understood it. And the trial judge's findings that Pate was, in essence, effective, if you don't answer that question in the affirmative, how can you properly analyze whether he was prejudiced? And again, I'll go back to the game-changing events on July 7th, and that he didn't tell him about the once he had this super increased exposure under the July 7th indictment, he does nothing. And the government wrote in part that Third, Pate admittedly provided defendant with no advice regarding the wisdom of not pleading guilty at the arraignment on the bill of information, which was August 3rd. And as they go on to say that essentially it was a plea offer, and yet he gave him no advice and didn't even inform him that the plea agreement was out there. So to me, that's clearly ineffective counsel. And the trial judge can't say, well, he wasn't prejudiced by anything because he didn't do anything wrong. You have to look at, and again, got 35 seconds. I better conclude. Thank you very much. Right. Do you have any more questions, Your Honor?
No. Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your help in our understanding of this case. This is the final argument for this morning. We are in recess.